Welcome to the Hobcast Book Show, a weekly podcast from Hobeck Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, mystery, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of running a creative business in this challenging world. We'll hear from the people who make this possible, the authors, the cover designers and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on the Hobcast Book Show from Hobeck Books, as we combine trad values and an indie spirit.
Hello.
Hello, and welcome to the Hobcast Book Show, episode number 122. My name is Adrian Hobart.
My name is Rebecca Collins.
And together we run Hobeck Books, UK independent publishers, of the following four genres:
mystery,
crime,
suspense,
and thrillers. Welcome to the show. And our guest this week is
Jude Austin, speaking from
Japan.
Chiba in Japan.
Chiba in Japan. Lovely to speak to Jude, and we covered all sorts of topics there, and it was fascinating because, again, we're talking about different genres to the ones that we focus on ourselves.
Yes, and we also go into childhood and space and AI and all sorts of things.
Yeah, lots and lots
of
topics.
Sword fighting.
Sword fighting, indeed, yeah. that's what you learn if you go to Japanese stage school. Acting classes. So, yeah, you have to be a wielder.
Well, they are quite into that, aren't they? Because you have, what's it called? Japanese fencing. I can't remember. Kendo.
Yes.
Yeah, so they're into fighting with sticks.
They are. Well, it was a pleasure to speak to her. But I think this week, as we always start with some news, I mean, really, there are two bits of news that dominate everything. And this first one is something we've debated all week as to whether we should talk about it. Because those who regularly listen to the show know that last week we were at Crime Fest in Bristol.
We were indeed, yes.
Now, we left mid-afternoon Saturday, just after recording what you heard last week. And that evening, everyone was preparing for the big dinner, which is a combination of, you know, it's a big set to dinner with an awards ceremony as well on the Saturday night. You're looking puzzled.
Yeah, because I thought that was the Friday, the giving out the shortlist and the longlist.
No, that's the CWA Daggers get announced.
Sorry. Okay. Stand corrected.
no.
No wonder we were oblivious to any issues because of how dash we left.
Well, it was interesting because a lot of people were saying, you know, they were, for those people who got the Sunday morning slot, the assumption was that everyone would be quite drunk from the night before and wouldn't show up for the early morning panels on
Sunday.
Let me
guess, it was packed.
Yeah, they were. But for those of you who have been following this story, you'll know what we're talking about. But for those who aren't, we want to familiarise ourselves with what has happened. So this week has been a very difficult week for everyone involved in Crime Fest. We're thinking particularly of Donna and Adrian, who run it. And the reason is that on the Saturday night, the Toastmaster was a gentleman called Peter Guttridge, who is a very well-known figure in crime fiction circles. He has run the Brighton Literary Festival in the past. He is also a crime critic for Crime Fiction Critic for The Observer.
And he writes as well, doesn't he?
He writes as well. Yeah. He's a very, very successful and polished and well-regarded novelist. And he's been going to Crime Fest for years and emceeing lots and lots of panels and been very supportive of the festival. He was Toastmaster on the Saturday night. And as I say, there are awards being given out as well. Which, you know, specifically for books for this competition at Crime Fest.
Yes.
And all sorts of furore came from his speech. Now, we don't know the details of what was said. The first indication that something had gone awry, at least publicly, was a series of tweets by another author who was nominated, Finn Longmore, who is currently studying at Cambridge University and was nominated for one of their books. And there was a long series of tweets about how offended Finn felt about the way that Peter had opened his speech, talking about pronouns. Now, there was no detail attached to that, But that then encouraged a few other people to say that they were also offended by it, including people that we are we know and respect and are friends with. And Graham Bartlett, he reported back to the organisers that he was unhappy with the views expressed during the Toastmasters speech. Mm. Ellie Griffiths also expressing that. And of course, this then caused a huge Twitter storm from a lot of people who weren't there.
So I think what we're essentially saying is we can't comment about what actually happened because we weren't there, but we are very interested in what happened after.
Yeah, so the impact of all of this has been huge, and it has basically opened up a chasm within the crime writing community. And Peter himself has defended what he said in the sense that he did talk about his concerns about the rewriting of classic fiction, particularly around Roald Dahl. But also we've seen it in recent weeks with Ian Fleming and Agatha Christie and a few others. And this is a concern that is widespread amongst, you know, authors, particularly authors of a sort of more established reputation, I suppose, you know, older generation. Salman Rushdie has talked about it as a big concern. And indeed,
I was going to say, interestingly, Martin Amis, who we're going to talk about later.
Yes, we're going to talk about Martin later because, of course, that is the second big story that he passed away on Friday. And we want to reflect on that because he was a giant of literature and
Brit-lit.
One of the greatest authors of the last 50 years, without question, and one that's influenced us both, and had some very interesting comments on the cancel culture. But basically, this has opened up a whole chasm of vitriolic tweets and counter-tweets from all sorts of people.
Oh, I mean, it's actually been difficult to concentrate on my work.
Yeah, it has. It's been what, you know, I have felt very emotionally drawn into it and angry, actually, and upset by the whole thing. And it is symptomatic, I think, of the way that Twitter in particular, but social media in general, has coarsened the discourse, if you like, and redacted it to, you know, one view good, one view bad kind of approach. Mm. And the level of counter-accusation and shaming that's been going on both sides has been awful to witness.
And I suppose it's not a debate. So I don't mind a healthy debate, and people have different opinions and different viewpoints, and I think that's always been the case through the history of mankind, you know, and that's part of what makes us interesting, that we debate things and we have different opinions. But on Twitter, especially, it's almost like you can't express an opinion without either side. I'm not, you know, talking about either opinion, but you can't express an opinion without the other side just jumping on you and just shouting you down.
Yes, and indeed, there's been a lot of shouting down of people who've been asking just for more clarification as to what actually was said, as opposed to, you know, lots of things thrown out there in a very vague way, but we don't specifically know what was said that was so offensive because we weren't there and no one has really shared that. But, you know, as I say, if people who we respect and like very much, like Graham, are saying that they found it offensive, then, you know, there is a certain line that that's crossed for them.
Yeah.
But I would say that, you know, then there's been this campaign for Peter Guttridge and indeed other people to be future, you know, banished from going to such events. And indeed, you know, let's not forget how much energy and effort they've put into chairing a panel, because if you do one of those things, you have to read all the books of the authors involved.
You say that, but
well,
yeah.
That's the idea. I mean, you know, that's, you know, it doesn't, it's not an inconsiderable effort. Having said that, I appreciate that for certain people, any questioning of pronouns and indeed any of those issues is an immediate red rag.
Yeah.
And it red flag, and it just, you know, triggers a lot of assumptions that people who say these things must be a certain type of person, whether it's transphobic, homophobic, whatever it is. Now, I don't think necessarily that's fair, but I think there is a genuine, and I've made my views clear on this in terms of rewriting classic literature to make it more acceptable for modern audiences. I'm not comfortable with that. In fact, I'm not. You know, it goes stronger than that. I think it's fundamentally wrong, and I think it talks to the things that George Orwell warned us about, and indeed a lot of senior authors are now, you know, established figures are saying this is wrong. It is stifling creativity. Look at Anthony Horowitz and his views on how he feels his work has had to be reworked and forced through the filter, in his view, of sensitivity readers, and how that has changed his creative process, and he's not comfortable with it, and he's not happy with the end product. Equally, I understand that there is a need for people to, you know, they are fighting for their rights and for their views and for their for acceptance in society. But at the same time, by taking the extreme route of cancelling and shaming and all that stuff, I actually don't think it helps. I think it polarizes debate and just entrenches, you know, rather than actually trying to encourage people to look at things afresh and new, it is stifling debate.
Yeah, but those people who are fighting for their right to be treated equally and understood aren't necessarily thinking the same way about rewriting fiction. They might not necessarily have that view.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, they may not. And that is the point, isn't it? I mean, you know, there is, it's a very broad church. And the crime community, crime writing community, the fans and the authors and the editors and the publishers, we're a broad church. We come from different backgrounds. We come from different socioeconomic classes. We come from different political points of view.
Yes.
And
I mean, look at the two of us for a start.
Right. Well, you know, the point is, yeah, I mean, it's all very well for me to sit here as a middle-aged, middle-class, university-educated white bloke, right? He worked for 25 years at the BBC and all that stuff, and was born in Cambridge, so I'm Southern as well, just to sort of pile it on. There is an assumption. I go to these events now. We've gone to these events over the last 3 years, Harrogate, Crime Fest, Bloody Scotland, a few other sort of smaller festivals. And each time we go, and I think this is an important factor, you know, our heart's in our mouth a little bit. We don't know how it's going to go. We don't know who we're going to see. Certainly the first times we went, it was very, very difficult to feel part of it because we didn't know anybody.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it, you know.
And, you know, we're introverted, even though we present a podcast and we run a publishing company and I've been a broadcaster. It doesn't not, you know, I'm still an introvert at heart. And I find it excruciating to go and walk up to somebody, you know, I want to speak to, you know, some of those big names that have been on this podcast. I can't begin to, you know, you and I know the sort of, we've gone around in circles building ourselves up to have the courage to go and approach Sir Ian Rankin and ask for an interview.
Yeah, I mean, when I think of Harrogate, I think of walking up that hill of the hotel. So just the drive that leads up to the hotel, and that, my stomach just going, ooh, and I see all the people milling around in the beer tents.
It's terrifying for people like us. Now, I think that is an experience that is often shared by people attending these things for the first time, or indeed authors getting onto a panel for the first time. I think that a lot of people within our community are introverted. You know, 90% of authors probably fall into that category to some extent. And that going on a panel, I think Nadine Matheson was commenting on Twitter about this, and I think she made a very good point, which is that chairs of panels need to be aware that, you know, while they might be doing 10 panels, and it's water under a bridge for them because they're doing it for years, for those first-time authors turning up, and, you know, who feel intimidated by being in front of three people, facing a room of 100 is a completely different thing. So you've got to make them feel comfortable. Because one of the other complaints was that certain chairs have made first-time authors, or indeed particularly women authors, uncomfortable in the way they've been involved in those panels. So that's another issue in a way. They cross over. It's very difficult to complicate, but that's also caused a huge range of opinion coming forward about how badly people feel they've been treated at these festivals by certain people. And I think there is an element of that needs to be addressed here in terms of being warmer, friendlier, and more inclusive. But then again, I would flip it round and say, look, if you are somebody who's been going to these things for years, has loads of friends in the industry, it's a bit of a get-together. You know, you're going to gather together, and it's going to look like a clique to those on the outside. And that's how it's felt to us sometimes. I've often criticised Harrogate. It's nothing to do with, you know, it's just human nature.
I was going to say, it's just like when you go to the playground, you've moved house to a new school. Yes. Your children have moved to a new school.
And it's a very good analogy.
As a mother, I've been in that situation where you go to the playground for the first week and the first few days and everyone's in groups and you just think, you're thinking, somebody come and talk to me because I can't talk to you.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's that same sort of thing. And it's not that they're being horrid or mean or... It's just they know each other. They're friends.
Yeah, and they've got that relaxed confidence that they've all known each other and they're well-established and all that sort of thing. And I think that there's an element of jealousy that has prompted some of these comments. However, I would want, you know, it's unacceptable for women to feel uncomfortable because, you know, some people describe, you know, lecherous men coming at them and all that sort of thing. Well, there's a big article in the bookseller.
But one point I'd like to make about that, though, is that it's not just crime festivals.
No,
and
it's
The thing that upset me about that was the focus on crime festivals. And I thought, well, you know what? That is in all walks of life. So that's nothing to do with crime festivals.
Yeah, there is a wider issue that needs addressing. But at the same time, I think that, and this is, I'm not trying to victim shame or anything like that. I'm just trying to say that sometimes we bring our own, you know, in our anxieties when we go to an event like this, we sometimes project it on other people. It's their fault that I feel like this. And actually, perhaps it isn't. You know, it's a contributory factor, but actually it lies within you.
Yeah, so I think what you're saying is, to use the playground analogy again, you go to the playground and you're thinking they're not being friendly, they're being mean, they're not thinking of including me, and it's not that, they just don't notice you're there.
Yeah.
Or...
Yeah, there's an element of that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's difficult for us to sort of draw conclusions to this, but I would say that I wanted to reflect on this because it really has dominated my thinking. I've lost sleep over it. I have an inbuilt anxiety around being the person I am.
Well, I think what got me is when you said, because we have debated a lot.
Yeah, we've talked about
it. In the middle of the night and all sorts. And when you said to me, I don't know if I want to go to an event again because people might make the assumption, because I'm a white, middle-class, posh, university-educated man, that, you know, they might be slightly fearful or of what I might say or what I might do or how I might act or if I buy them a drink.
There is an element of me fearing how anything I do is going to be interpreted. And I think to put this in context, I want to be very honest about this. You know, I've talked at length about my departure from the BBC, but in the last few months I was there, or as a member of staff, I was hit with people saying that I'd used inappropriate language historically, and as a result of that, I was facing an HR inquiry if I chose to find out what was actually I'm alleged to have said. Now, I wasn't allowed to know that, so I left the BBC. I resigned. I'd already decided to resign because I couldn't stand working there anymore for my mental health. I was falling apart. And I was in great trouble, and I still suffer from it now. 3 years on, I've still got post-traumatic stress disorder from it. My last 3 years there was living hell. And, sorry, I'm getting quite emotional about
this.
That's
okay.
But I want to share this because this is important. And I felt, and I still feel to this day, that part of what happened is down to, yes, I don't know what I'm supposed to have said that caused offence and brought these allegations against me. So I just don't know. And I was never allowed to know. So I have no closure on it. I have no understanding. And trust me, I would never want to make people feel that way.
Mm.
That was never at any point in my life been my intention. So I'm left hanging, and this will be left hanging for the rest of my life, not knowing what I'm supposed to have done. But I would turn this around and say, I also think that at that stage in the organisation, there was a general effort from the top to rebalance the profile of the staff, and particularly management. And basically, they had decided as an organisation, there were too many people like me, middle class, university educated white men, in positions of management.
Mm.
And I was the first to go, and most of my contemporaries within the department I was working, and I'm thinking of about eight different people, also fitted that category, have all been subsequently left their jobs because I was the first to be made to feel that I was surplus to requirements, and worse than that, they were actively looking for opportunities to pile the pressure on. And the damage that did, you know, look, I can tell you that I was going into the office and thinking, how do I get through the day? Spending hours crying in a corner because I've just felt so ashamed of being who I was, and wanting to make a big gesture of tying a rope around my neck and throwing myself off one of the bridges at Salford Quays. That's all I could think about at times. And that's never been addressed. And I'm telling the world now that that's how I feel still. And so I now don't want to go to festivals where anything can be misinterpreted because people are going in with the assumption that people of my background are part of a problem that most of people in my background don't perceive and don't understand. And it's being projected upon us. And that's why I won't put myself into those situations. And so therefore, I will not be going to Harrogate this year. I just will not do it.
Okay. Well, what I would say to people who may have that perception is say, I would say to them, well, tell us. You know, people of a different generation, we haven't grown up in with the same... it was just a different culture, different times, and that, you know, it doesn't mean you're a bad person because you're of that generation. But educate, you know, don't attack someone for saying the wrong thing. Educate them. Tell them why in a measured, you know, kind way, what the problem is with the way they've behaved or what they've said. Educate them. Make them understand.
Yeah, but don't go into it with the assumption that everybody...
Exactly, yeah.
Because if it was reversed and this is exactly the thing that most of the people who are fighting on over these issues, you know, they're fighting because they've lived through prejudice and assumptions made about them because of their backgrounds, right? The same thing, you can't just reverse it and therefore two wrongs making a right here. They don't. Now, you might... A lot of people are going to listen to this and I'm going to probably cop a load of Twitter abuse or whatever. Oh, yeah, you know, educated white, you know, privileged bloke, you know, moaning about the situation. But genuinely, you've got to appreciate the damage that you can do. And I think that it's very hard for me to put it... I mean, I'm trying to express this and it's probably not the right forum, but this is very important to me. This has dominated my life for the last 3-4 years. You know, I'm the one having the nightmares still.
Yeah. So, I mean, somebody could come back to you and say, yes, but I've suffered in the past because of the way the culture was. Now, my argument to that is, does that mean that the suffering has to be put on someone else? Because you're a victim in a way. You're a victim of your times, of your background. Just as much as everybody is a victim of their background in some way, in, you know, if they've been marginalised because of their background or their race or their gender or anything, so are you a victim now of your background? So why should you suffer?
I am a product. I wouldn't say a victim. I'm a product of my background. I am a product of my background. And I will I can't deny that there are values and behaviours and things that have come from the fact that I was privately educated till 16. I brought up in a big house in Cambridge. Not particularly well off, but certainly rich in terms of cultural exposure. And
sort of intellectually rich.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. And, you know, I went to a university which is, well, you know, one of the poshest in the universe, as we both did.
I know. I felt that when I went there, you know, I was completely out of my depth.
All of those things are true. But, you know, at the same time, I bring a certain level of values to what I do in life and I try to live by those. And sometimes, like everybody, I err from them sometimes. But I feel that I am sitting in a situation where I never got my chance to say my piece because I was so low mentally at the time when they said, well, it's your choice if you want to fight this or not.
Oh, you're talking about the BBC?
Yeah, yeah. Going back to that, I've never had the chance to express, you know, to know what I'm supposed to have done and then have my opportunity to defend myself.
Yeah, because I think everybody should have the right to reply with full knowledge.
Right.
And you can't reply if you haven't got full knowledge.
Taking back to this Crime Fest situation, if you're putting it, I mean, you know, look, I'm not trying to jump one side of the debate or the other, but the fact is that Peter Guttridge has been now judged in the public. And everybody who said things about him has then sort of shut down their Twitter accounts and gone hiding again, or refused to spell out exactly what it is that's supposed to cause this level of offence. And so he's in a situation where we're led to believe, and we haven't had this confirmed by Crime Fest, he won't be invited back next year. And people were saying on Twitter, don't go to a festival he's involved in anymore. And that's, again, you know, that is a very snap judgment. Mm. I mean, is it proportionate? Is that really what we stand for nowadays? And I just, and this goes back to cancel culture, which I abhor. I do. I absolutely abhor it, because it shuts down debate totally.
Yeah, it's a shutting down debate. That's the important thing.
You know, we've gone through generations. You know, there's, you just look through history. There's so many examples of where when it becomes, you know, you have to think a certain way. And so many of our best writers have warned about this. And we're going to get to Martin Amis now. So yeah. let's draw, because this is going to be a very long episode, but I needed to express what I feel about this, because it has had a very detrimental effect on how I felt this week about things. And I no longer feel about the community in general that I want to engage at these forums anymore.
Yeah, but I think
that's horrible.
I know, but I think you've got to accept that it's just the loud voices that we've seen, the loudest voices on both sides of the debate.
Yeah,
there's a whole lot in between all that.
No, I know, but I think it's going to take me time to come to terms with that and want to engage.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
That's just how I feel about it. Anyway, look, well, let's turn to Martin Amis. And so the news broke yesterday. We're recording this on the Sunday, and so the news broke that he died on Friday in Florida of cancer of the esophagus, aged 73, and, of course, son of Kingsley Amis. So a sort of literary dynasty, satirical literary dynasty, and a towering giant of late 20th century English fiction, without question. One of the most influential authors of the last 40 years, no question about that.
Yeah, I need to buy the Rachel papers for Josh. Actually,
yes.
Because that was his
breakthrough work. And I've read London Fields as well.
And I've read, was it Yellow Dog?
Yeah.
I've read that.
No, they're
as well.
Great. They're great books. And look, they're fairly far removed from the fiction that we publish. But we are, you know, huge fans of great writing, and he undoubtedly was. But he was a great thinker of life, I think, and had that clarity that came through. So I've picked out a few quotes, but this one I think is pertinent to what we've just been talking about. In fact, there are a couple. He had views on cancel culture, and which I'll get to in a moment. But this one was published 11 years ago, and this is his views on ageing. We're children all our lives. Until you're 45 or so, you still think you're going to live forever. You look in the mirror and think, well, most people die, but in your case, clever you. Lucky you. And then you pass 60 and you think, hang on, this'll end in tears. But aging isn't the steady accumulation of wisdom or knowledge. It's constantly improvising to meet new circumstances. I think that's really important. We're like children all our lives, because every 10 years we have to acquaint ourselves with a new set of rules. Being 50 is not at all like being 30. You're always feeling your way. And you get a bit wiser as you get older, but you don't get physically braver. As a child, I expected that. As a grown-up, I was shocked to see it hadn't happened. And I just want to sort of repeat that line. We're like children all our lives, because every 10 years we have to acquaint ourselves with a new set of rules. And that's exactly what we're talking about here. We're talking about rules being set by a different generation.
Yeah, culture changes.
We pushed things through when we were younger. We were totally passionate about things. And then you get to a certain point. And actually, what I think is true here is that if you're talking about people of a certain age, the older you get, the harder it is to adapt to the new sets of rules or indeed understand them. And I think that is at the centre of what's happened at Crime Fest.
Yeah, and that's my point. You know, educate. If you think somebody isn't living within the rules in the right way, educate them as to what why you think that and what they can do to improve. Because nobody wants to hurt anybody, I don't think. You know, if they're essentially a good person, they don't want to hurt the feelings of another person or make them feel uncomfortable or so.
Yes. I'm just looking for the further extraordinary life in quotes. Here we go. It's in The Guardian. And this, I mean, I'm going to finish with a positive one about writing.
Yes, good.
But I think that there's, on cancel culture, this is just what Martin Amy said about this. Every fibre in my being resists. It's a Philistine manifesto. It's anti-creativity. Appropriation means taking without permission. Who do you ask permission of? It's getting that way in every direction. I got bollocked for writing about the working classes in Lionel Asbo, but I've been doing that since I started.
True. Very true.
And then let's get to a couple of things on writing. To me, it seems like a part-time job, really, in that writing from 11 to 1 continuously is a very good day's work. Then you can read and play tennis or snooker. 2 hours, I think most writers would be very happy with 2 hours of concentrated work.
I know why you like that one.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. And I think there's another one about what makes you a writer? You develop an extra sense that partly excludes you from experience. When writers experience things, they're not really experiencing them anything like 100%. They're always holding back and wondering what the significance of it is, or wondering how they do it on the page. And I love this thing about signing sessions, because, again, this is a crime fest kind of thing. I find that people take my writing rather personally. It's interesting when you're doing signing sessions with other writers and you look at the cues at each table and you see definite human types gathering there. With Julian Barnes, his cues seem to be peopled by rather comfortable professional types. My cue is always full of, you know, wild-eyed sleaze bags and people who stare at me very intensely as if I have some particular message for them, as if I must know that they've been reading me, that this dyad or symbiosis of reader and writer has been so intense that I mustn't somehow know about it.
That's interesting. I like Julian Barnes too, actually.
Yeah. he's a huge loss. And, you know, there were controversial elements, and he was unafraid to say things that put people's noses out of joint, evidently. But I think that we lose somebody who's extremely powerfully creative and changed the direction of literature. So, you know, sad, but I think his views on aging, absolutely. I mean, the clarity in that thinking that, you know, we're always adapting to new rules and sometimes we don't adapt and that's where things break down. I think that's really very, very powerful.
Yeah, I agree. We should go into the interview now,
I'm sorry. Yes, enough of my, my ranting and raving. Let's go into our interview, yes. Well, Jude is an author of sci-fi. And we hadn't really touched on sci-fi. We did cyberpunk not so long ago.
So, yeah, it's refreshing to have something different again.
Absolutely. So we speak to Jude Austin over in Japan. Well, it's really lovely to be speaking to Jude Austin. Welcome to the Hobcast Bookshop.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
It's great. You know, we are recording this early-ish on a Tuesday morning because... the time difference.
Yes, you're last week we spoke to New York, and this week we're speaking to where?
Oh, you're speaking to Chiba, Japan.
Fantastic.
Near Tokyo.
Fabulous.
So it's early evening for me.
So we've got to ask, what brought you to Japan? I mean, you we were talking before the interview, and so you've been there 8 years. I mean, that's amazing.
Well, I used to live in Fuerteventura, in the Canary Islands, which I loved, but there wasn't much work there. So I had a couple of Japanese friends, both on the islands and in UK. I was starting to get an interest in Japanese language, Japanese culture, because I love languages. I love learning them. I love inventing them for my writing. So I thought, okay, I will go and do a homestay, which I did in Osaka and Yokohama. And I just fell in love with the country and I came back to the Canaries and I put in for a student visa, which I got about a year later. And then I went to Japanese language school in Yokohama. And then I went to film school in Tokyo. And then I kept going to film school in Tokyo, but moved to Chiba. And then I got married and I've been here ever since.
Well, that's awesome. What is film school? I've got to ask about film school in Japan. That's that it sounds amazing. What sort of disciplines do they specialize in? I mean, is it, you know, hours and hours of watching Kurosawa films or what? I don't know.
We did have a subject like that, yes. Basically, they had a lot of different areas. So you had the acting area and the production area. And I started in the acting area because I really wanted to get into musical theatre. But sadly, I injured my knee. And the acting is very, very physical.
Yeah.
Like we had an hour of calisthenics every morning, 2 hours of ballet on a Friday. And we had action, so like sword fighting. And there was no way I could do it. So I switched to the production. And from there, I did screenwriting, directing, Hollywood producing. And yes, we had a subject that was basically watching and analysing movies.
No, no hardship there, surely.
But was it taught in Japanese?
Yes. The one exception, we had a class called Hollywood Production. And the teacher was a producer, director, screenwriter from America. So that was taught in English with a Japanese interpreter. So I actually liked that one because I could really join in with the class.
Yeah. That's amazing. And is there a Japanese sort of school of thinking around?
I thought you were going to say
film production and filmmaking, because in a sense, I mean, some films have been enormously influential on Western culture, clearly, and Kurosawa is one of those directors who's had a big influence to the point where, you know, The Magnificent Seven's a remake, isn't it? And it's of Seven Samurai. So I just wondered how much of a sort of Japanese philosophy is passed down through generations of filmmaking, or is it sort of a wider perspective than that?
The Japanese way of thinking is very strong in the physical acting classes. So, for example, when we did the sword fighting, we had the wooden katanas. And they are really heavy. They're about 3 feet long, solid wood. And we would do like 50 moves, followed by another 50 moves, followed by another 50 moves. And then we might get a break.
It's about stamina, yeah. Isn't it?
But if someone made a mistake, we had two teachers and they were always going back and forth among the rows, just watching and looking. And if someone made a mistake, they would stop the whole class. But you would stop in position. So that would be like in the middle of a squat with this 3-foot sword over your head, and you would just have to stand there without moving until they finished straightening this guy out. And then you had to pick up exactly where you left off. So that was really hard. It was fun, but I wasn't sorry to drop that class, to be honest.
Yeah, I dare say. I mean, that is amazing. You know, I mean, I know that, you know, graduates of RADA can ride a horse and can wield an épée or something as part of their sort of curriculum, but that's taking it to another level, isn't it?
It is, really, yes. And we also did acrobatics.
Really?
So, really. So it started with the kind of thing we used to do in gymnastics class at school. So forward rolls, backward rolls. And then it would go on to handstands, hand walking, back flips. And I was really upset because that was the class I really wanted to do. And like I say, I blew my knee out before we could start the really good stuff.
Oh, that's a shame.
It is. Yeah. One day I will do a backflip.
Well, I'll hold you for that.
Yeah. I mean, these are things I couldn't do at school. I mean,
I could walk three. I think I could do four walking on my hands.
No. I mean, you could forget. I mean, I can't do a forward roll now, but I couldn't do a backward roll when I was at school.
Forward roll.
I was hopeless. And yeah, I was quite sporty, but I just couldn't do the
coordination thing. Not bendy like me.
No, I'm not at all flexible.
No,
you're right.
So
wow, that's a hard schooling. I mean, that is extraordinary. So, I mean, we've got to obviously move on to writing, which is the purpose of this podcast. But
yeah,
as ever with me, I'd like to go down a cul-de-sac if I hear something that piques my interest.
Yes, I also think people would be interested to hear this.
Because I, you know, with all that background, you know, a lot of character development for authors is, you know, one of the tips that people are given and that they could think about pursuing is actually looking at it from an actor's point of view. How do you build a character as an actor?
Yeah.
What facets of that character do you manifest physically and vocally and all the other things? You know, what do you try and also inhabit in your head to give life, you know, you're in close up. You've got your eyes to convey what you're thinking and acting. And one of the things that I indulged in a couple of years ago was to get the masterclass with Samuel L. Jackson, who talks about this a lot. Uh-huh. And he's not necessarily known for his writing, but he was saying that he can never enter a scene without a specific thought in his head. And it's often not even the thing that he's supposed to be thinking as a character. He's thinking about the washing up or something. But as long as he's thinking about something, his eyes light up. And I just wonder whether when you're building characters, some of that screenwriting, obviously, but the acting comes into play when you're creating your characters
and worlds as well, because you know, I know that in your genre the world is a very important element of it.
See, this is hard because for me the creative process is far more of an ongoing thing. I'm a pantster, I'm not a plotter, so yeah.
You're with the Pantsers Union here, so yeah, absolutely.
Fantastic. I knew I wasn't the only one. So my characters and my worlds kind of evolve organically as I go. So like with One Planet, Trandelia, I never sat down and thought, okay, I'm going to invent a world. I just thought, okay, I need a planet that's not Earth. That's a cool name. I'm going to draw a map just so I have some point of reference. And I'm going to see what comes out. But if I'm struggling to move on, like if I get writer's block, very often what I do is I act the scene as every character in that scene, so I can only do this when no one else is in the house.
So some solo improv. And do you how do you capture that? Do you record it? Do you video it? What would you do? Or just use it and then get it down on paper?
I just use it and get it down on paper.
But do you find that an effective way to get through the writer's block? Because I've never heard of anyone doing that. So I find that quite of you.
No, I have. I mean, that's something I do. I mean, as you know, I will, you know, 3 a.m, go into character sometimes.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Start improving as so-and-so, you know.
Yeah, I suppose. Okay. But
yeah, and I have done that. Yeah, definitely.
You're more likely to be Michael Caine at 3 a.m.
That is correct.
You've got to be one of the greats if you're going to do it at 3 a.m.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's, I don't know.
It's a bit unnerving, though, if I'm half asleep and I think I'm next to Michael Caine.
And I'm doing the bit where he gets a little bit, he's trying to find the right word and getting a little bit hesitant. And, darling, do you think you could pop down and make me a coffee?
No. Something like that. Short answer, no. 3 o'clock in the morning, no.
Well, that's how he met his wife, wasn't it? Because she was on the Maxwell House coffee advert.
It's got 3 o'clock in the morning to make him a coffee.
Well, I thought that would be part of the deal. I mean, no, okay, right. I'll digress.
Yeah, so, well, except for that, his funny 3 o'clock in the morning thing, I haven't really, not many people have said that they've done the sort of turn it into a physical performance, but I like that idea. That's a good way to sort of almost get your energy going, I guess. And
it's really good for stress. Right. So even if I don't have writer's block, if I'm feeling stressed or worried, I just come up with this spontaneous improvisation in my head and act it out and Fantastic. Yell at the walls. And then my cat comes and attacks my feet and then it's all over. But it's good while it lasts.
It's good about that, aren't they, cats? They, you know, getting in the way when you don't need them.
Yeah.
I know this is something that Rebecca wanted to talk about. So you mentioned maps and is a big feature on your website as well. The care and attention you pay to making maps of the worlds that you're creating for your science fiction. How much time goes into that process?
A lot less now I've discovered the website that does it for me. So I draw it out with pen and pencil. And then I don't have a scanner, so I just take a photograph, upload that. And there are a couple of really good sites where you can upload your images and then just draw over the top. And so that's what I do. It takes about 3-4 hours to go from sketch to finished.
Yeah, and they're beautiful. I mean, I had a quick look, and
Thank you. You
know, the sort of the depth and the dimension and the, you know, the colouring and all that sort of thing. It's fantastic what you can achieve. But it brings me on to one of our pet subjects at the moment, which is, in a sense, that's using AI to help your creativity, isn't it?
It's using a tool to help my creativity.
Yeah, it's not entirely. Yeah.
No, I'm not suggesting that it's, you know, it is. It's fleshing out the original intention, which is slightly different to make me a world and I'll write about it, which is what AI is currently doing for a lot of people.
Mm. I like the maps because we were at Crime Fest in Bristol on the weekend and we were having dinner with two writers, one of which is ours, and Graham Bartlett, who is sort of police consultant to the stars, as I call him. And I was telling them that when I was a child, I used to do maps of Beano Town because I read the Beano. And I thought, well, everybody did this. I was quite surprised. They looked at me a bit surprised because Brian Price has his own fictional town. And I thought, if it was me, I would have drawn the town and put where all the shops are. And I thought that was normal, but apparently not. So it was really good when I saw your website and realised that, you know, there are other people who draw fictional maps.
Yeah, it's normal for some of us.
Do these feature in the books themselves, or is this just something you have on the website and you keep for yourself?
They haven't been put into the books themselves, no. I might do that, but to put them into the books, I would have to do, like, just plain outline. So you'd lose a lot of the colour, a lot of the detail. Because printing a colour map would be prohibitive. I don't know any author, indie or professional, that's actually done that.
No, that's true. It'd definitely have to be black and white, wouldn't it? And
yeah, but Tolkien-esque.
Yeah.
Yes.
It was a great one. Do you know, I'm going to shock you now, Rebecca.
Oh,
you've
made
me for a long time, and actually I have to confess that I used to make maps.
You didn't say this when we were at dinner the other night. You made me look like I was a bit geeky and weird.
I did play that. Yes. No, I mean,
it's very
I did. I made a street map of Mos Eisley, which is from Star Wars.
Oh, right, yeah.
Long before the Mandalorian went back there, or you know, Boba Fett and all that stuff. I wanted to sort of put the cantina scene in context and, you know, working off the basis of what you actually get to see, I sort of created a whole thing when I was younger. But that's because, and this is, brings us back to you, Jude. Mm-hmm. When I was 7 years old, after Star Wars came out, and I was mind blown, and so was my closest friend at the time, Andrew Clark. Andrew mm-hmm. was a real devotee of science fiction at that stage anyway. He had every Doctor Who book you could imagine in Target. He was reading Isaac Asimov. He was much brighter than I was. And we sat down together and we created something called The Saga. It's what it never got a proper name, but we were co-writing a sci-fi saga. And that was the basis of all the times we went to play at each other's houses, was to go and essentially write the saga. We didn't get more than about 10 pages in. But I know that that will chime with you because you started writing at 11 and started building your own sort of sci-fi sort of world and experimenting with it. And so I just thought that, you know, we should share that passion, because I've never taken it any further with sci-fi, although it's still my number one thing to watch.
Yeah. I mean, I first got published at 11, 12. And that wasn't sci-fi, that was actually Pony magazine.
Brilliant.
Of all things.
So what was that short story, was it?
They were doing a serial called Valentine Farm. And at the end of the first episode, there was this little, I don't know, call to action. So, you know, do you think you could write an episode of Valentine Farm? Well, send in your ideas. So I did, and I got a letter back saying, oh, we would love you to write episode 5. So I did that.
That is amazing.
That's so cute. That's like every child's dream, isn't it? Oh, I love that. So did you get the book then from that point on? Did you think that's it?
Yeah, that early validation must have been a very significant moment.
I wish I could say yes, but the truth is no. I've been writing, not seriously, but since I could hold a pen. Literally, I used to make my own books from post-it notes. Yeah? And I don't know if you can still get them, but when I was very young, my parents had a business from home. So we had a lot of office supplies lying around. And you used to be able to get like post-it notes that were about that thick with a hole in one corner to put your pen in. And I would just take a wadge of those and I would write a little story. And when I finished that, I would write another little story and I would fill notebooks with stories. But I never really thought of making it a career until I was about 18. And that's when I wrote, it was a fan fiction, because I'm a huge supporter of fan fiction, any way, shape or form. I think it's the best way for any writer to learn their craft.
That's a good point,
And this one was about an actor. And the story was mine. It was just, the actor wasn't. And when I finished it, I had about 70,000, 80,000 words. And I thought, oh, that's a book. So, okay, I just changed the actor's name. And it needs a lot of reworking, so I don't suppose it'll ever see the light of day. But that's when I thought, okay, maybe I could make a career out of this.
Yeah, because, I mean, the number one challenge for any author is actually finish, and you did.
Absolutely.
That
I think every author's got their bottom drawer book, haven't they? Because that happens quite a lot. Of people say to us, I wrote a book, it's never seen the light of day. But it gives you that start, doesn't it? And it teaches you what you need to do, so that when you have a bit more confidence in what you subsequently write, you can do that.
I have about 10 completed novels. Only 4 have been published and 1 I have disowned. So really, I only have 3 completed novels. Let's forget the fourth part.
Right. No, I mean, that's, I'm glad you brought up the subject of fan fiction, because within my own family, my niece writes fan fiction as well, as, and she's very, very creative, and it's really her number one outlet, you know, because she has, she's suffering from considerable ill health at the moment. And she writes fan fiction.
It's K-pop, isn't it?
K-pop, yeah, yeah, around K-pop. Yeah. And she's got a really big following on Wattpad as a result of this. And
what, so Wattpad?
Wattpad.
What is Wattpad?
Wattpad is is a it's a sort of short form platform where, you know, you can upload your stories and people subscribe to read them.
Oh, like Kindlevella?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, it's the,
like,
original.
Fanfiction.net, but right, for original fiction too.
Yeah. And as you say, I mean, because in a sense you're exploring how to write within a world that already exists, or with characters that already exist, that is, that takes, you know, that allows you to focus on the mechanics to a degree, and finding your voice, without the additional challenge of creating everything from scratch.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Also, people do like fan fiction. They like to read about people. I mean, it depends what it is, isn't it? But if the world's already been created to a certain degree, or it's a slightly different world, they like to read about it because they love the original. So, yeah, it's definitely a space for fan fiction.
But moving from fan fiction through to, you know, your original work now, how difficult was that transition? Was it organic and very natural?
It was organic. I still write fan fiction. They're like two separate styles of writing for me. So, and as I say, I've been writing original, very short stories since I was very young. So it was kind of, I did both side by side. I mean, when I was 11, I wrote something called the York story. And I called it this because I started it on the way home from a school trip to York. It has never had a title. It never will have a title. And I think I still have most of the books. But that was basically an aliens fan fiction.
Okay.
And that spans like 7 notebooks. I have no idea how many words.
Wow. But
occasionally I take it out and I look at it, and it was written by an 11-year-old, and it shows. And I kind of switch between cringing and hysterical laughter.
Yeah, but, you know, nonetheless, you did that. And, you know, so was Sigourney Weaver's character involved in that fan fiction, or was it a spin-off with the rather wider Marine?
Based in York, presumably.
Actually, no. As I say, it was just written on the way home from York. No, it was the Marines. It was only the Marines, because I was going through a bit of a military craze at the time. And, you know, oh, I want to join the Army. I want to join the Navy. I want to join the Marines. So for me, and because I saw aliens when I was a lot younger, the Marines were the cool guys. You know, you've got Sigourney Weaver, you've got the emotional journey she goes through as Ripley. But at 11 years old, I didn't appreciate that. So for me, it was just the Marines with the guns blowing things up.
I think a lot of people go through the military phase.
I've never been through a military. Oh, I did watch Private Benjamin and thought, oh, that's me. Is that a military phase?
Not necessarily. No. I mean, I definitely had the sort of pre-teen military phase, and I'm still fascinated, as you know.
Yeah.
Because I'll watch anything involving submarines.
My youngest is in, what does CCF stand for?
Combined Cadet Forces.
Yes, that. I just call it CFC, and he gets upset then. He says, it's not CFC, it's CCF. And he when he comes to say goodnight to me, so I'm lying in bed, and he comes in to say goodnight, what's it called? Like, he kind of marches, and he turns, and he salutes, and he turns, and he's like, oh, goodnight then.
Could be worse. He could be saluting you with, you know, other hand gestures. So, no, that's good.
No, that's what you do.
Oh, quite.
But what I find, you know, and I was a sort of devotee of things like Warlord comic and Commando and stuff like that. And I, you know, I still have a hankering to read those sort of things.
Well, there's something in the bathroom that's got an army man on the front. What's
that? That's a military fitness thing, which never gets opened by me. I know you read it.
You did a lot. It's fascinating.
Yeah. But nonetheless, I know how the gumption to do it, but I do find that whole thing fascinating. And I think it's the discipline and the, you know, the sort of, spirit in which, you know, things are achieved collectively in that environment. So, I mean, in terms of your writing, how much does that still rub off on in your world? Are your sagas and your sci-fi militaristic in any way, or is it exploring other aspects of life?
I write what I call sci-fi realism, which is basically sci-fi with no AI, no dystopia at all, no evil governments, basically a nice optimistic look at the future. So there is the military, and one planet is very militaristic, but it's more, they take the military seriously, but it's quite mild. So think MASH.
Mm, okay. I love MASH.
Me too. I was watching it before we started talking.
It was my Wednesday night treat, MASH was. BBC Two, Wednesday night, 9 o'clock. I don't know how I remember that, but...
So, yes, it kind of influenced it a bit, I think. But I don't write military sci-fi because there's quite a lot of that out there already. So I prefer to focus on day-to-day life, day-to-day people. I'm a big fan of found family in like my work, and my fan fiction has a lot of found family themes. I don't know why it does.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting you say that, because I mean, an awful lot of science fiction has been around, you know, reflecting concerns about the future. You know, go back to Aldous Huxley or something like that, and you know, genetics and things. And that is increasingly prevalent now, as we're actually beginning to live in a reality where AI is so influential. Is it an escape in that regard? You know, not, you know, putting aside those technical influences and
the bad people.
Yeah. Is that part of the appeal to you?
Yes. I mean, I don't understand why everybody thinks the future is going to suck. I've never.
I think we always have done, though, haven't we? We always see technology as bad.
But I am very, very opposed to AI development. I always have been. I think we could spend the money on much better things. And, you know, I don't care if I can have a conversation with my microwave when I'm 80. That doesn't interest me. What does interest me is, when I'm 80, will I forget my husband? Will I forget everything we did? Will he forget me? You know, I would far rather see the money for AI put into something that would benefit humanity as a whole, like a cure for Alzheimer's or much better treatment for Alzheimer's, than making a talking toaster or a robot that can flip burgers at McDonald's. You will not find any AI in my books for precisely that reason.
But I think that's refreshing, isn't it? Because we don't always want to read about the doom and gloom of what could happen, and do we? So
I don't know. I mean, I lean towards dystopia. It's just always been my nature, really. If I'm honest, you know, I have. Ever since, you know, Orwell and all that stuff I was reading as a teenager.
I think that's slightly different, isn't it? That's a very...
And I remember writing something for English, and I got a really bad mark for it, and it started that the opening line was,
they were coming. And, you know, it was sort of like a paranoid.
Now, that's going to go down in the history books as a good first line, isn't it? They were coming.
And he
goes, I'm interested. Who were coming?
Shit again, you know. But they were coming.
You did the voice well, though.
Well, that's my thing, isn't it? I mean,
they were coming.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I think if I'd been able to read it out loud, it might have made a better impression. But, you know, that's often the way, isn't it? That you can't predict how people are going to react to it. But I thought it was a really good piece. But yeah, it was a paranoid sort of dystopian world I was writing about. Yeah,
this is making me think that all we've been talking about as well, that children are natural writers of fantasy and sci-fi, because we've all done it at some point in our childhood, or most children have, and then some go on and carry on and perfect that, and others like you and me, because I certainly don't anymore, unfortunately, we just sort of lose that. I think that's quite sad.
I got penalized in school for writing sci-fi, fantasy, anything. So when we did English coursework for GCSE, it would always come back, and everything, every story I wrote would come back pure fantasy, but still very good. I was like, you know, guys, the two don't have to be mutually exclusive.
Yeah, that's really tragic, isn't it? Because they weren't valuing it.
No, and for my Excel exam, we had to make this spreadsheet calculating averages, etc. You know how you do. And all the other students did like book sales, CD sales, and I did the number of aliens entering the Zfoom system.
A bit.
And we had a checklist. You know, this is what you must do to get a pass. This is what you must do to get, I forget what they call it, distinction, whatever. Mm. And I ticked everything for distinction. And my teacher confirmed, yes, you've done everything. The exam board gave me the bare pass because it wasn't books or CDs.
Well, because it wasn't based on actual reality. That is harsh.
That is harsh.
That's really
harsh. Everything else was fine.
So do you think this, this bias against fantasy writing creativity still exists within that sort of sphere, or have things moved on?
That's a very good question. I think part of the other reason I wanted to come to Japan was because they are far more accepting of fantasy settings. And if I wrote, okay, there's a game, very old game called Shining Force, which is a fantasy role-playing game, came out for Sega. And there are all these different races. And I can't help feeling if I wrote something like that in England for a UK audience, people would turn around and say, but how did this happen? How did that happen? Why are they doing this? Wouldn't they do that? Wouldn't they do this? And in Japan, it's just like, who cares? That's the world. The important thing is the story.
I think that's a very good point, because it's a while since I lived there, but I can I know what you mean. They love living in an alternative environment in their imagination. That it doesn't matter. Why would you bring in reality and start questioning things? Because you're there because you don't want reality. But we are very cynical, I think.
It's an interesting question, because we haven't always been, as a culture, as didactic as we are in UK and the West in general. Because if you think about the legacy fiction that we've grown up with, Lewis Carroll,
yes,
Tolkien,
yeah,
lots of examples you can pluck out, which are fantasy worlds, and they are, you know, a bit of Rudyard Kipling even. They, you know, there's a lot. As a culture, we were a lot more accepting. And indeed, if you think about
the fashion in Victorian England for heraldic stories of and Arthurian tales and things like that. This has always been part of it, and yet somehow now it's become a niche. It's become, oh, you're one of that lot, geek kind of approach. I now want to know why and how that's happened.
Mm.
Oh, you and me both.
Is it? Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I hadn't thought of it like that.
You know, or even in the 1950s, John Wyndham is very influential on me, thinking.
Yeah.
Indeed, they were coming, influenced by John Wyndham. You know, that's all, that was extremely popular stuff and mainstream fiction. And now it would be seen as, oh.
Well, it's a niche. Yeah. It's like romance as well. It always upsets me when people say, oh, romance, that's like lowbrow. We've become much more divisive in where we put literature, I think, in this country at least. So
far more judgmental.
We need to change this.
You do. Yep.
Well, we're reaching that point, I'm afraid, where we need to either raise the tone or lower it. I don't know which one sometimes, depending on what comes out of Rebecca's mouth in a moment. But it is time for Is the Voice. Rebecca's random question.
Well, I'm going to start off with an apology to the audience because this is not as random as normal. And it's because you live in Japan. So my random question is based on living in Japan.
Okay.
I would like to know, what is your favorite Japanese word and why?
Oh, boy. I have a whole second language. You want me to pick one word?
Yes.
I can give you my favorite hiragana.
Go on then.
Te.
Te. Why te? See, he's probably thinking, what?
Yeah, what are these strange people talking about? It was the first one I learned to read.
Okay, it's quite an easy one, isn't it? Because it's just like.
Yeah.
See, I remember it.
What's yours then?
Like you, there was so many. There's lots of words in Japanese that don't have a one word translation in English. You might be able to describe it, but there's not necessarily just one single word. And there were many. And one of them was e, as in ina.
Oh, saw it.
Also genki. I loved genki because it could mean healthy, but it also could mean sort of emotionally well, as well as physically well, or just sort of not quite cheerful, but just sort of okay.
Okay, I've got one. I like shiawase. Because for the audience, Japan, in English, you have one word for happy. But in Japanese, we have two. So ureshi and shiawase. So ureshi is like you're happy about something good that's happened. But shiawase is a really convenient word because it means I'm happy, not for any particular reason, but life in general is good.
It is interesting, isn't it? There are these words that we don't have. But we know what you mean by that, but we would just use happy.
If it was my elder son, it would just be decent.
Yeah.
That's the only word he ever uses for anything.
Another Japanese word I remember very well, not necessarily because I liked it, but because I taught in a high school, I heard this word all the time. Kawaii!
Oh, yes.
It kind of means cute. But we don't have an equivalent either because it's sort of like cute or pretty or makes you feel good or you like, aesthetically pleasing it could be.
It's all like the concept of cuteness.
Yeah. But the girls would say it all the time. Mm. You'd show them a picture of something and they go, kawaii.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. I'm struggling to join in this conversation. Japanese words.
I ask you, can I? Because I normally ask you the question too. Your favourite Japanese word. You haven't got one.
Sapporo.
You like okonomiyaki?
I do like okonomi.
Sushi? Sashimi? You like all that?
Yeah, absolutely. Totally.
What about takoyaki?
Yeah.
So no. Okonomiyaki, just talking digression into Japanese. I loved okonomiyaki in Japan, and you couldn't find it anywhere in the UK. There's one, I know of one okonomiyaki restaurant in London, and that's it. There's probably more now, but.
Oh, I'm going to make you jealous. I do like ambassadorial work for Japanese company Otofuku Sauce, and they are trying to market okonomiyaki to the West, including UK.
Excellent. So that makes me happy.
What they want to do is they want to roll out this kind of make your own okonomiyaki kit. So with the flour, with the sauce, with the spatula, with everything. So you might see it in your local supermarket in the future.
I would love that. I would absolutely love it because it was my favorite just sort of comfort Japanese food. And yeah. The other teachers, we'd go out and we'd have okonomiyaki and then go sing karaoke and drink lots and lots and lots of beer.
Yeah.
Well, that's, and, you got my mouth watering now, and it's mid-morning.
On MasterChef, one of their skill tests was okonomiyaki, but it was completely wrong. They just, and I was thinking, you're MasterChef, but you're not cooking it properly.
Yeah, well, that's...
It was like, then they kept calling it pancake, Japanese pancake.
Yeah, that's John Perrault for you, who has, ruined many an East Asian cuisine. In the name of MasterChef.
I was getting very upset there, wasn't I? I say it's not a pancake.
No, you're quite right. Well,
it is not a pancake.
It's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you. Where can people find your work online and more about you?
Okay, so I have a website, which is www.judeaustin.net. And you can also find me on Amazon. If you search Five Worlds series, you'll get my work.
Fantastic.
Actually,
and I'm also
on
fanfiction.
I know that because I searched your name on Amazon. You came up. So.
Oh, good. I'm still there. That's good.
Brilliant. Well, look, it's been an absolute pleasure. We've covered a lot of topics and probably none of which any of us expected to be talking about.
But we never know what we're going to talk about.
That is the nature of the podcast book
show. The builders have just come out because I can see them on the roof. They're sweeping the roof next door.
Oh, good timing.
That's quite a way to finish, isn't it? Yeah. Rushing away.
It's not a euphemism.
No. A crack has just opened up on that roof, so to speak.
Oh, God. I'm started now.
With that smutty joke, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much, Jude Austin, for joining us.
Yes. Thank you very much.
I wish I had her gift for languages.
And me too, especially because I lived in Japan and I struggled to learn the language. I really did. I'd spend most of my weekends trying to get my head around it. But, after 2 years, I've probably had about an A-level of Japanese, but I've lost it all now, except for the odd word.
No, you haven't.
Konomiyaki, sayonara. Konnichiwa.
Oh, you know more than that. That's for sure. Well, anyway, look, it was a real pleasure. Who are we speaking to next week?
So next week, not a writer. We're talking to an editor, Abby Rutherford, who I've corresponded a few times with Abby. I'm looking forward to the interview because she has pets and dogs. I believe a corgi, I'm not sure. Mm. And she says that normally gets interrupted when she's on Zoom. So I actually hope we do.
Yeah, well, no doubt.
Because we'll probably get Katus interrupt us this end.
Probably. She's disappeared off somewhere. I don't know where. It's a big week for us. We've got another book launching.
You say that every week.
No, it's a big week because we have a book launching.
Yes, we do. And I'm really excited about this book because I absolutely adore the cover designed by lovely Jane. So this is The Bad Neighbour by Jenny Ensor.
Yeah.
So it's sort of like it's a perfect summer book, in my opinion, because it's set during the spring and the summer of 2020. So you
COVID.
Yes. But did you know you can't mention COVID or words associated with that time in Facebook advertising?
I had no idea.
So I had to sort of, I think I put summer 2020 because I couldn't put lockdown, I couldn't put COVID, I couldn't put pandemic.
Really?
Yeah, they don't like it. They don't like it.
That's astonishing.
Anyway, so it's set during that time and it's basically about what happens, because as you know, during that time, your world shrinks
vastly shrinks to just the people you live with or possibly the people in your immediate community, especially as things sort of started to open up a little bit. And it's about what happens to the minds of those people when there's one dark secret amongst them.
Wow.
So it's good. It's a summer read. It, in my head, it's always sunny there. So.
And it's 99p for it launch. Is.
I know. We're mad, aren't we? But go for it. Buy it. 99p.
The Bad Neighbour by Jenny Ensor.
It's not going to be 99p for long, just a couple of weeks. So make the most of the opportunity.
And in the last few days, we've also released a new audiobook, Cousin Ash, narrated by A.B. Morgan, written by Sue Shepherd. That's
yes.
newly out. So take a look at that and go and find it on all available
I know,
platforms.
It was actually on Audible before it published. Lauren to themselves.
Here's news. Audible have got their act together. That's unheard of. Well, that is very encouraging. And so, we've got a week to half term.
Yes.
My son James has started his A-levels and has his History Tudor A-level
actually,
paper
got,
this week.
In this house, a week of exams because Josh has got lower six mocks.
Right.
And Toby's got end of year 8 exams.
Yeah, and so. My son Ben is just starting his finals at Loughborough.
And yeah, Leeds is doing Luke exams. Luke is doing exams in Leeds.
What is it about the summer? Why ruin it with so many exams? But that's what they do. And that is the nature of life.
Yes, but I have happy memories of lying in the sun with my books and the Stone Roses on my Walkman and things like that.
Mm. Well, we'd like to, I think we should wrap the show up now. Thank you so much for listening, and I appreciate that for some people, things that we've talked about will be difficult, and some people might disagree with what we've also said.
But I like that, though. Healthy debate.
But we
need more of it.
And I think we've tried to cover all sorts of aspects of it, but ultimately, the crime community, in fact, the whole of society, you know, we just need to stop shouting at
and
each other.
And just be kind. Just be kinder to each other.
And start talking to each other.
Yeah.
And I hope that, you know, this episode reflects that because it's been a tough week, and I think the ripples from this will carry on for a long time. And I think, you know, perhaps some of these things needed to be said and expressed, perhaps not in this way.
I actually agree with you. Yes, I do. I think things do need to be said, but that's what I'm saying. I'm saying talk about it, say it, but don't shout it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, look, join us again next week. For the Hopcast Book Show. It's been a real pleasure to speak to you, even if it has been one of the more challenging episodes for us to deal with. Thank you so much for joining us. And don't forget to go to our website, www.hobeck.net, for our fiction side of things, our authors, audiobooks, our books. Archpub.net for our publishing services.
Yes.
And between now and then, we wish you a wonderful and
creative
week. Bye bye.
You've been listening to the Hobcast from Hobeck Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hobeck.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hobeck online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to the Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.